Imagine just sitting down at a professional trading desk.
Oh, like one of those massive setups with the six monitors.
Exactly. You are completely surrounded by screens. There are these cascading red and green numbers just flying by.
Right, ticker tapes scrolling at the speed of light.
Yeah, and breaking news alerts, screaming about, interest rate hikes or geopolitical tensions.
Supply chain disruptions, quarterly earnings
Yeah.
misses. Yeah, it's sensory overload.
It really is. And
Yeah.
the entire architecture of that modern financial media apparatus, I mean, it's engineered to stimulate your amygdala.
It creates this visceral, almost painful sense of urgency.
Right. It signals that if you don't act on this new piece of information right this very second, you are going to fall behind.
And we're culturally conditioned to believe that, right? We think navigating capital markets requires this overwhelming degree of complexity.
We do?
The underlying assumption is that sophistication requires convolution.
Like, it has to be hard to understand to be valuable.
Exactly. We look at the sheer volume of data, the complex algorithmic trading models, the derivatives
Oh,
markets.
the derivatives markets don't even get me started.
Right. And we internalize this idea that wealth generation is a puzzle that's only solvable by those with the absolute most advanced processing power.
Like you need a supercomputer to retire.
Yeah, but there's a deep psychological comfort in that complexity, actually.
Wait, comfort? How is that comfortable?
Well, because it provides an excuse.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, if the system is incomprehensibly complex, then our failure to navigate it well, it isn't our fault.
Right, it's a structural barrier. It's the system keeping me down, not my own choices.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this because today on this deep dive, we are doing the exact opposite of wading into all that complexity.
A complete 180.
Total 180. We are not looking at some sprawling macroeconomic white paper today.
No textbooks on quantitative easing here.
Thankfully, we are actually examining a piece of source material that is so intensely distilled, it almost feels like a provocation.
It really does. It's shockingly brief.
We are dissecting a single definitive thesis statement, seven words.
Just seven words.
That's it. The text we are diving into today reads simply, "Long-term investing, the path to wealth."
That is the entire universe of our source material today.
Yep. And my challenge to you, the listener, right up front, is to ask yourself something.
What's the challenge?
Ask yourself how often you dismiss foundational truths simply because they don't look complicated enough to be effective.
That is such a crucial question because it is incredibly common to brush past a statement like that.
Right. It feels almost too simple.
When you strip away the charts and the jargon, a seven-word maxim feels almost dangerously simple, like a bumper sticker.
Yeah, exactly.
But the simplicity is deceptive because to actually execute what those seven words demand, I mean, it requires a fundamental rewiring of how you process risk.
And how you value your own labor, too.
Yes. And most importantly, how you experience time.
Because the text doesn't start with money, does it?
No, it doesn't. It starts with a temporal condition.
The very first concept we are forced to confront is long term.
Leading with the modifier long term before introducing any action is such a fascinating structural choice.
It's like a gatekeeper.
Exactly. It acts as a gatekeeper. It essentially states that if you aren't willing to reorient your relationship with time, well, nothing else in the sentence is going to work for you.
You can't even get past the front door.
Right.
But I want to push back on this right away.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because long term feels like an incredible luxury to me.
A luxury? How so?
Well, it assumes you have this psychological and financial surplus to just wait. I mean,
Right.
if someone is dealing with the friction of daily survival, making rent, buying groceries, thinking about the long term feels completely disconnected from reality.
That tension is very real, and it highlights exactly why the transition to a long-term mindset is so remarkably difficult.
It's not a natural state.
Not at all. Human beings are not evolutionarily optimized for long-term planning.
We're really not.
No, behavioral economists call this hyperbolic discounting.
Hyperbolic discounting. Okay, what does that actually mean?
It means we are wired to heavily discount future rewards in favor of immediate gratification.
So a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush.
Exactly. Think about it in a Pleistocene environment. If you found a calorie source, you consumed it immediately.
Because you didn't have a refrigerator.
Right. The concept of storing a piece of fruit for a decade just didn't exist. It would rot.
So if you didn't eat it, you died.
Exactly. Our brains reward us with dopamine for solving immediate problems.
That makes total sense.
So, when the text demands a long-term posture, it is explicitly asking you to fight thousands of years of evolutionary biology.
Wow. We are essentially trying to run a modern financial operating system on prehistoric hardware.
That is exactly what we're doing, and the financial markets are acutely aware of this mismatch.
They prey on it, don't they?
They absolutely do. The entire concept of an equity risk premium, which is the reason you get paid a return on your capital in the first place, it's intrinsically tied to the fact that waiting is painful.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
You are literally being compensated for your willingness to endure uncertainty over a long horizon.
Because most people can't do it.
Right. If short-term certainty is what you require, the market will provide it.
In the form of cash, right?
Cash or short-term treasury bills. But the return on that certainty is functionally zero.
Or even negative once you adjust for inflation.
Exactly. You pay a massive premium for comfort.
So the long-term modifier isn't just a suggestion to be patient.
No, it's functional.
It is the actual structural mechanism that generates the yield.
It is the engine.
But how do we define the relativity of that time?
What do you mean by a relativity?
Well, think about a 19-year-old. A 5-year horizon for them feels like a massive percentage of their conscious life.
Oh, sure. 5 years feels like forever when you're 19.
Right. But for a 65-year-old, 5 years is just a blink.
A blip on the radar.
Yeah. So does the definition of long-term shift depending on where you, the listener, are standing?
What's fascinating here is that the source text deliberately leaves the numerical value undefined.
It doesn't give a number.
No. By refusing to say, 30-year investing or 10-year investing, it frames long-term not as a fixed calendar date.
But as what? A mindset.
As an operational philosophy, yes.
Yeah.
It is a posture of deferred gratification that scales relative to your specific objective.
Okay, I like that. A posture of deferred gratification.
But mathematically speaking, in the context of capital markets, long-term generally refers to a horizon broad enough to absorb and smooth out the macroeconomic business cycle.
So we're talking about outlasting the bumps.
Exactly. You need a timeline expansive enough that a recession, a supply chain shock, or a period of high inflation becomes a statistical blip.
Rather than a terminal event for your capital.
Precisely. It can't wipe you out if your horizon is long enough.
Which means rejecting a lot of very loud, very tempting noise.
So much noise.
If the framework is explicitly long-term, then anything that prioritizes the immediate present over the distant future is entirely outside the bounds of this philosophy.
It's out of bounds.
We are talking about rejecting the frantic, reactionary checking of daily portfolio fluctuations.
Yeah, you have to delete the app off your phone sometimes because it inherently rejects speculation.
And how are we defining speculation here?
Speculation is attempting to predict the behavior of other market participants in the short term.
Like trying to guess what the crowd will do tomorrow.
Exactly. That's speculation. Long-term investing, as defined by the first two words of our text, is about capturing the underlying economic value created by human ingenuity over decades.
That's a huge distinction.
Those are two entirely different games played on entirely different fields, even though they both use the exact same financial instruments.
You know, this makes me think of the fundamental difference in how we interact with the physical world. Let's pressure test an analogy here.
Okay, I love a good analogy.
I say the short-term approach is taking a bucket down to a river.
Okay, bucket, river, got it.
You fill it with water and you carry it back to your house to drink today.
Makes sense. You solved the immediate problem.
Right. You're not thirsty right now, but the moment you are thirsty again tomorrow, what happens?
You have to walk back to the river.
Exactly. You have to expend the exact same amount of labor. You are trapped in this one-to-one exchange of energy for resources.
That sounds exhausting. So what's the long-term approach in this scenario?
Is long-term like planting an oak tree from an acorn, knowing you might only enjoy its shade decades later, whereas short-term is just buying a potted plant?
Well, that works, but let's stick with the river. I think the river analogy captures the action better.
Okay, yeah. So the long-term approach in the river analogy is spending weeks, maybe months or even years, building a water wheel in the river.
Ah, building infrastructure.
Yes. During the construction phase, you have no water.
You're just sweating in the mud.
Exactly. You are expending massive amounts of energy with zero immediate payoff. You probably look absolutely foolish to the guy who's just carrying his bucket back and forth.
He's laughing at you while he's drinking.
Yes. But once that wheel is built and it's seated in the Cornish, It captures the kinetic energy of the river.
It pumps the water for you.
Exactly. You have decoupled your physical labor from the acquisition of the resource.
That is beautiful. And I take that a step further, actually.
Where does it go next?
The water wheel analogy perfectly captures the transition required by the very next word in our source text.
Investing.
Investing. Notice the text does not advocate for long-term saving.
Right. It doesn't say that at all.
It specifically demands long-term investing. The water wheel is a piece of capital equipment.
It's an asset.
Yes. It requires an initial sacrifice of resources to build, but it generates its own momentum.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. The distinction between saving and investing is wildly misunderstood out there.
Oh, fundamentally misunderstood.
We are often taught from a very young age that saving is the ultimate financial virtue.
Put your money in the piggy bank.
Right. You earn capital, you put it into a secure vault, and you protect it. But our source text ignores saving entirely.
Because saving, in the context of modern fiat economies, is structurally designed to fail over the long term.
Wait, designed to fail? That's a strong statement.
It's the truth. If we connect this to the bigger picture of how global economics function, central banks intentionally target a positive inflation rate.
Usually around 2%, right?
Give or take, yeah. This means the underlying currency is engineered to lose purchasing power year over year.
It's a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. It encourages consumption and greases the wheels of the economy. If your money is worth less tomorrow, you'll spend it today.
Which is good for the economy.
Great for the economy. But for the individual holding cash, it means the bucket of water you brought back from the river is slowly, invisibly evaporating.
Let's put some numbers to that because it's terrifying.
Let's do it.
If you put $100,000 under your mattress, and inflation runs at an average of 3%.
Which is pretty historically standard.
Right. In 24 years, your purchasing power is cut completely in half.
Half your wealth just gone.
You still have the exact same number of paper bills, but they buy half as much reality.
Exactly. Which is why the action verb investing is non-negotiable in this text.
You can't just save your way to wealth.
No. You can't. Investing is the process of converting your decaying fiat currency into productive assets that inherently capture inflation and economic growth.
So you're turning the paper into a water wheel.
Yes. When you invest in equities, for example, you aren't just buying a fluctuating ticker symbol on a screen.
It feels like that sometimes, though.
It does, but you have to remember what that symbol represents. You are purchasing fractional ownership in a living, breathing commercial enterprise.
You are buying a tiny slice of an organization.
An organization filled with people.
Right. It employs engineers, researchers, marketers, and logisticians. And all those people wake up every single day with the sole objective of solving problems, creating value, and increasing the profitability of that company on your behalf.
It's incredible when you think about it. And the math backs that up.
How so?
Well, when inflation rises, the cost of raw materials goes up, right?
Everything gets more expensive.
But a well-managed company simply raises the prices of its goods and services to absorb those costs.
They pass it on to the consumer.
Exactly. So the revenue goes up, the nominal earnings go up, and the value of your fractional ownership increases.
It acts as a shield.
It does. Investing is the mechanism by which you align your personal capital with the forward momentum of global human progress.
Wow.
Saving is playing defense against a system designed to erode your purchasing power. Investing is playing offense by owning the system itself.
It's the difference between stagnation and kinetic energy.
Beautifully put.
But making that leap, you know, from earner to investor, that requires a massive psychological identity shift.
It really does.
Yeah.
Because most of us are conditioned to view ourselves strictly as laborers.
Right. We rent out our cognitive or physical abilities by the hour.
We trade time for money.
But labor has a hard ceiling.
Right.
I mean, there are only 24 hours in a day.
And eventually, our bodies and minds slow down. We can't work forever.
Right. Capital, however, does not sleep.
Never.
Capital does not get sick. It does not require a vacation. And it is infinitely scalable.
It's the ultimate employee.
It really is. The text demands that you deploy your capital as an independent workforce.
But that transition is uncomfortable.
Why? Because of the risk.
Yes. Because a bucket in your basement feels safe. You can look at it. You can touch it.
Even if it's evaporating?
Even if it's evaporating, yeah. Right. Whereas a water wheel out in the river that is exposed to the elements,
it could get washed away in a flood.
Exactly. When you invest, you are placing your capital out into the wild where it will inevitably experience severe weather.
Which brings us perfectly to the punctuation in our source text.
Ah, the colon.
Yes, the colon. We have long-term investing, followed by a colon.
It's a structural bridge.
It really is. It says that the condition and the action on the left side of the equation will mathematically result in the outcome on the right side.
Cause and effect.
Right. And the right side begins with an incredibly vivid spatial metaphor.
The path to wealth.
Let's look closely at the phrasing there. It does not say a path.
No, it doesn't.
It says the path.
The use of the definite article they is a very aggressive philosophical stance.
It feels exclusionary.
It is. It removes ambiguity entirely. By stating it is the path, the text dismisses alternative methodologies as either statistically insignificant anomalies or outright illusions.
Okay, I see what you're saying, but is it entirely accurate to call it the only path?
You have some doubts.
Well, yeah. I mean, people build immense fortunes through highly concentrated risks, don't they?
Sure they do.
Like starting a tech company, inventing a disruptive product, or leveraging massive amounts of debt in real estate. Those are paths, too.
Those avenues certainly exist. I won't deny that. But they are subject to extreme survivorship bias.
Survivorship bias. Unpack that for us.
Well, we see the founder who rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange, right?
No, on the cover of all the magazines.
Exactly. But we don't see the thousands of founders who went bankrupt trying to build the exact same software in their garages.
Because nobody writes articles about them.
Right. Creating a unicorn company is a lightning strike.
It's rare.
It's incredibly rare. You cannot build a replicable systemic philosophy on the hope of catching lightning in a bottle.
Okay, that makes sense.
Long-term investing is presented as the path because it is the only democratized, mathematically sound route available to the broader public.
It doesn't require you to be a genius.
Exactly. It relies on structural economic realities rather than exceptional individual luck or, you know, once-in-a-generation genius.
So it's the definitive route for the statistical majority.
Yes, for you, the listener. It's the path that actually scales to everyone.
But the word path itself carries so much weight. A path is something that exists on the ground.
It's tactile.
It is tactile.
Yeah.
It implies a journey that must be actively navigated step by step.
It isn't a teleportation device.
No. You don't just decide to become an investor on a Tuesday and wake up wealthy on a Wednesday.
That would be nice, but no.
A path implies a starting line.
Yeah.
You don't just appear at the end of a trail. You have to take the first step.
And taking that step takes courage.
It really does. But honestly, staying on a path when you're tired is the hardest part.
Because a path is the physical manifestation of compounding progress.
A step after step after step.
Exactly. It connects present discipline to a future outcome. But what's crucial about a path through the wilderness is that it is rarely perfectly smooth or linear.
Oh, absolutely not. Anyone who has ever been on a long hike knows that the terrain changes drastically.
It's unpredictable.
There are stretches where the ground is flat and you make incredible time. You feel like a superhero.
Right, the bull markets.
Exactly. But then there are also brutal inclines where your lungs burn and you feel like you are expending massive energy just to move a few inches forward.
The stagnation periods.
Yes. And worse, there are descents where you actually lose elevation.
Oh, those are the worst.
You watch your progress temporarily evaporate. You're walking downwards, undoing all the climbing you just did.
In the context of our text, that uneven terrain is market volatility.
Volatility. The dreaded V word.
Volatility is the structural reality of the path. It is mathematically guaranteed.
You can't avoid it.
You can't. Markets are essentially forward-looking pricing mechanisms. Millions of participants are constantly analyzing new data.
Like the interest rates and supply chains we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. Consumer sentiment, corporate earnings, and they are adjusting their valuation of assets in real time based on that data.
It's a constant recalibration.
Yes. Because the future is inherently unknowable, the collective guess of the market is constantly fluctuating.
Right.
That fluctuation isn't a glitch in the system. It is the system.
But dealing with that volatility emotionally, that is where people fall off the path.
It's the ultimate filter.
It really is. I mean, it's one thing to look at a historical chart of the stock market and rationally understand that it trends upward over decades.
The line goes up from bottom left to top right.
Right. On paper, it looks so easy. But it is an entirely different visceral experience to log into your account and see that your portfolio, the capital representing your hard-fought labor, has dropped by 30% in a matter of weeks.
Because of some macroeconomic shock halfway around the world.
Exactly. Your brain just screams, danger.
That is where the psychological phenomenon of loss aversion dominates human behavior.
Loss aversion. Tell us about that.
Studies by Kahneman and Tversky demonstrated this beautifully. They showed that the psychological pain of losing $100 is roughly twice as intense as the joy of gaining $100.
Twice as intense. That's wild.
We are neurologically wired to prioritize threat detection over opportunity.
Because missing an opportunity meant you went hungry, but missing a threat meant you got eaten.
Precisely, survival of the fittest. So when the market violently contracts, the amygdala fires, inducing a state of panic.
Fight or flight.
Yes, the immediate instinct is to stop the pain. And the only way to stop the pain in that moment is to sell the assets, lock in the loss, and step off the path entirely.
You retreat back to the perceived safety of cash.
You run back to the bucket.
You abandon the water wheel and grab your bucket.
Exactly. But stepping off the path during a period of volatility is the single most destructive action an investor can take.
Because you make it permanent.
Yes,
Yeah.
you are permanently converting temporary market fluctuations into permanent capital impairment.
You sell at the bottom.
You sell at the bottom, and then, paralyzed by fear, you inevitably miss the subsequent recovery.
You're still hiding in the bushes when the path flattens out again.
Right. The path demands that you endure the terrain, recognizing that a steep descent is not the end of the trail, but merely a feature of the landscape.
And the other major threat isn't just fear, is it? It's the temptation of the shortcut.
Oh, the shortcuts are everywhere.
When you are trudging along this slow, deliberate path of long-term investing, the sheer boredom can become a vulnerability.
Boredom is a massive risk factor.
You are walking along step by step, and suddenly you see an off-ramp.
A shiny new sign.
Right. You see a billboard or a
Yeah.
social media influencer or a news headline promoting an explosive new asset class,
A meme stock.
a meme stock, a highly leveraged option strategy, whatever it is. Someone on the side of the trail is yelling, "Forget the long path. I have a shortcut through the woods that will get you there by tomorrow."
The illusion of the shortcut is incredibly seductive.
Because it preys on our desire for efficiency.
Yes, and our latent greed.
Right.
But in financial markets, the relationship between risk and reward is inextricably linked.
You can't separate them.
You can't. If an asset offers a potential for overnight exponential gains, it structurally carries an equivalent risk of catastrophic total loss.
So the shortcut is almost always a detour into a minefield.
Almost always. And it incurs frictional costs along the way.
What do you mean by frictional cost?
Every time you leave the main path to chase a shiny object, you are paying a toll. You pay transaction fees, you pay bid-ask spreads, and most destructively, you trigger taxable events.
Right, the government takes a cut every time you switch lanes.
Exactly. You bleed capital in the pursuit of speed.
Which brings us back to the psychological fortitude required by those first two words, long term.
It always comes back to the long term.
The path is slow. It requires an acceptance of boredom as a feature, not a bug.
I love that. Boredom as a feature.
Compounding capital is not supposed to be entertaining. If you are seeking adrenaline, the financial markets are the most expensive casino on earth.
Go skydive instead. It's cheaper.
Exactly. True investing is the quiet, methodical accumulation of assets over a time horizon that outlasts the noise.
Yes.
So we have the temporal condition long term. We have the kinetic mechanism investing. We have the structural reality of the journey, the path to.
Which brings us to the final word of the text.
The terminus. The destination we are supposedly trying to reach through all this discipline and endurance.
Wealth.
Wealth. It's presented as the natural, inevitable conclusion of the equation.
But what makes the single word so endlessly fascinating is its subjectivity.
Right. The source text refuses to quantify it.
It doesn't say the path to $1 million.
It doesn't say the path to a
It
yacht.
simply says wealth.
And that ambiguity is where the real philosophical weight of the text lies, I think. So what does this all mean for you, the listener?
It's a deeply personal question.
Because if the text doesn't define the destination, the burden of definition falls entirely on you.
You have to draw the map.
You have to decide what the end point actually looks like. And society's incredibly terrible at teaching us how to do that.
Oh, society actively miseducates us on this.
We conflate wealth with visible consumption.
This raises an important question regarding the fundamental difference between being rich and being wealthy.
Ooh, I love this distinction.
They are treated as synonyms in pop culture,
Right.
but functionally they represent entirely different relationships with capital.
Let's explore that divide
Yeah.
because I think understanding this is the key to surviving the path.
Absolutely. Being rich is a state defined by current income and the conspicuous consumption of goods.
It's outward facing.
Entirely outward facing. It is the expensive luxury vehicle, the massive mortgage on a sprawling estate, the high-end designer clothing.
The bottle service at the club.
Right. To be rich requires a massive, continuous influx of cash because the lifestyle is incredibly expensive to maintain.
It's a highly leveraged position, isn't it?
Extremely leveraged. If the high-paying job disappears or the business takes a hit, the rich aesthetic collapses rapidly.
Because the capital is constantly flowing out the door to service the consumption.
Exactly.
The rich person is just carrying an incredibly large, incredibly heavy bucket of water.
Oh, that's brilliant.
They still have to walk to the river every day. They just have a fancier bucket.
That's a perfect application of the analogy. Yes. Wealth, conversely, is unseen.
It's invisible.
It is. Wealth is the capital that has deliberately not been spent to upgrade a lifestyle.
It's the money you didn't use to buy the luxury car.
Right. Wealth is the portfolio of index funds quietly compounding in the background. It is the modest car driven for a decade. It is the paid-off mortgage.
Wealth is silent.
Wealth is silent. It is an internal state of financial security.
It's the water wheel turning when nobody is watching.
Precisely. And the ultimate dividend of wealth is not the ability to buy more physical objects.
What is it then?
It is the acquisition of autonomy.
Autonomy.
Freedom.
Freedom. Wealth buys you the most finite, unrenewable resource in the universe, your own time.
You can't make more time.
You can't. Wealth is the ability to wake up in the morning and have complete optionality over how you spend the next 24 hours, who you spend it with, and what projects you choose to engage in.
But let's look at how easy it is to lose sight of that.
It's so easy.
Psychologists talk about the hedonic treadmill. Oh, the hedonic treadmill is brutal.
As human beings, we rapidly adapt to new levels of comfort or luxury. You get a raise, you upgrade your apartment.
Naturally.
That new apartment feels amazing for about 6 months. And then it just becomes your new baseline. It becomes normal. And suddenly, you need an even nicer apartment to generate the exact same level of dopamine.
You're running faster just to stay in the same place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you don't define what wealth means to you before you start accumulating it, the goalpost will move forever.
The mindless accumulator.
Yes.
That is the tragedy of walking the path without a defined destination. You endure the long-term horizon, you deploy the capital, you stomach the volatility, and you accumulate massive resources.
You do everything right on paper.
You do. But because you never define what enough looks like, you never transition from the acquisition phase to the deployment phase.
You never enjoy it.
You spend your entire life building the water wheel, and you die of thirst before you ever take a drink.
Wow. It's like spending your whole life training to climb a mountain.
Okay, another analogy. Let's hear it.
You buy the best gear, you endure the grueling ascent, you navigate the crevasses and the storms.
You put in the work.
Right. And finally, you reach the absolute peak. But instead of sitting down, taking off your pack, and actually enjoying the spectacular view, you immediately start looking for a higher mountain to climb.
You don't even pause.
No.
No.
The action of climbing becomes a compulsion that overrides the purpose of the journey in the first place.
Which is why the final word of the source text demands intense introspection.
You have to know your why.
Wealth must be calibrated to your specific values. For one individual, wealth might mean accumulating enough capital to completely step away from the corporate workforce at age 45 to pursue art or philanthropy.
Early retirement.
Right. But for another, wealth might mean the absolute security of knowing their children's education is fully funded without incurring debt.
Or just the security of knowing a medical emergency won't bankrupt them.
Exactly. The mathematical mechanism compounding equities over time is identical for both individuals.
The path is the same.
But the utility of the wealth is wildly divergent.
The path provides the math. You provide the meaning.
That is the essence of it. Action investing. Mechanism long-term path. Outcome wealth.
But understanding the mechanics of this seven-word equation is merely an intellectual exercise, isn't it?
It's just theory until you do something with it.
Right. The real utility of this text is in its application. How does internalizing this philosophy alter your behavior when the financial media begins screaming about an impending recession tomorrow?
If you've internalized the text, you simply turn off the television.
You just walk away.
You walk away.
Because
you recognize that the screaming anchor on the financial network is operating on a fundamentally different timeline than you are.
They need you to watch right now so they can sell ads.
Exactly. They are selling short-term engagement. You are building long-term autonomy.
So a market correction isn't a signal to abandon the strategy.
No, it's an expected feature of the terrain you already agreed to cross. You don't burn down your house because it started raining.
That's a great way to put it. You just get an umbrella.
You recognize that volatility is the toll you pay to access the superior returns of the path.
You have to pay to play.
You accept that enduring periods of extreme discomfort is the cost of admission for long-term compounding. You align your actions with the reality of economic expansion rather than the noise of daily fluctuation.
Okay, let's take a moment to pull all of this together.
It's recap.
We started with a source text that seemed almost laughably simple. Long-term investing. The path to wealth.
Seven little words.
But by breaking down the structural weight of those seven words, we've uncovered a comprehensive blueprint for capital allocation.
We really have.
We explored how long-term acts as a temporal gatekeeper, requiring a psychological shift from immediate gratification to deferred reward.
Fighting our own evolutionary biology to capture the equity risk premium.
Exactly. Then we analyzed how investing is the necessary kinetic action required to outpace the structural decay of fiat currency.
Transitioning the individual from a laborer trading time for wages into an allocator owning a fractional share of global human ingenuity.
The bucket versus the water wheel.
Exactly.
We navigated the path, acknowledging that the journey absolutely guarantees volatility.
We discussed the neurological traps of loss aversion that cause people to panic and sell at the worst possible moments.
And we exposed the dangerous illusion of shortcuts that promise overnight success but deliver permanent capital loss.
The detours into the minefield.
Right. And finally, we unpacked wealth as a highly subjective endpoint.
A state defined not by the loud, high-maintenance consumption of being rich, but by the silent, powerful accumulation of autonomy, time, and optionality.
Seven words. A profound intersection of mathematics, behavioral psychology, and personal philosophy.
It's elegant, really.
It is. But for you, the listener, while this deep dive has provided the map, while we have illuminated the mechanics of the terrain and the psychological pitfalls you will inevitably face.
The theory means absolutely nothing without execution.
Knowledge is inert until it is applied to reality.
The blueprint of a water wheel will not pump the water for you.
No, it won't. You have to gather the materials and stand in the cold river yourself.
You have to do the work.
So, as we close out this exploration, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over.
What's the final thought?
We've talked extensively about the structural integrity of the past
and
the critical importance of defining your destination. But reality is messy.
Extremely messy.
The noise is deafening. At some point, inevitably, you'll be tempted or panicked or distracted, and you will step off the trail.
It happens to everyone.
You will hold too much cash, or you will chase a speculative bubble, or you will sell during a crash. When that happens, when you realize you are suddenly wandering in the dense brush off the main trail, what is your protocol?
That is the true test of an investor. Not achieving perfection, but managing the recovery.
Exactly. Can you quiet your ego, accept the frictional losses of your detour, and chart a direct course back to the simple, boring, inexorable mechanics of the main path?
Or does the shame of the mistake force you to keep wandering the wilderness looking for a new magical shortcut?
The path is always there, waiting. It doesn't care if you left it. It only matters if you have the humility to return.
Well said.
Keep your bearings. Keep building your water wheel. And we'll see you on the next deep dive.